Welcome, Dumbheads, to the 2017 Mega Dumbcast New Year's Countdown. This year on Mega Dumbcast, I discussed the dumbest thing on every goddamn page of Palladium's Ninjas and Super Spies RPG. To cap off my misery and yours, I'm turning to The Rifter, Palladium's magazine slash supplement series for fan-submitted works. I'll drop an episode about one Ninjas and Super Spies article every day through the new year. Now let's continue the countdown with number 14. Today we're discussing The Rifter number 14 from April 2001. Finally, we are in the 21st century. I want to start today's episode with a couple of warnings. First of all, this issue features an adventure for ninjas and super spies. We've talked about two scenarios for this game before. This one is head and shoulders better than either of them. I do a podcast about dumb articles about ninjas and super spies, but, you know, they can't all be losers. This one is actually pretty good, at least in the beginning. That brings me to warning number two, which is you may start to get, a little bit mellow from all the positivity in the first part of this episode, but that mellow will be savagely harshed when I get to the big surprise in the middle of the scenario. So to signal that to you and avoid causing you any undue distress or trauma, I'm going to be signaling that mid-scenario surprise with a hackneyed record screech sound effect. Just so you know, just so you're ready, the record screech is coming about halfway through. With all that said, let's get into Destiny's Call, a scenario, really a campaign outline for Ninjas and Super Spies, which starts on page 38 of The Rifter number 14. Attentive dumbheads will recall, I was very excited when we were talking about Ninjas and Super Spies in season 1 to discover the Enfield number 2, a historically significant firearm in the pages of Ninjas and Super Spies in the core book, which raised the prospect of running Ninjas and Super Spies as a period kung fu adventure in like the 1940s or 1950s. This is a totally original idea for a genre, which I dubbed Chop Sockabilly. I am now entitled to royalties whenever a kung fu battle breaks out at a sock hop. Destiny's Call actually makes my dream a reality. It starts in 1945 with a group of player characters who work for the OSS in the final days of World War II. They've been assigned to train Vietnamese guerrilla combatants to fight Japanese occupation forces near the Vietnamese Laotian border. Now, back when I pioneered the chop sockabilly genre, I was mainly thinking of like secret agents in poodle skirts, like maybe some greasers doing Shaolin Kung Fu, a rock and roll Moogie Gong guy who kills people with his guitar. This adventure went a different direction and focused more on a comprehensive historical and political primer for the period, and then a skill system modification and equipment list to accurately simulate the actual military situation in Indochina in 1945, which is, you know, it's fine. It's not karate at the prom good, but it's good. Once you've made your characters, you're all OSS operatives, you've got all this historical information and modified character creation, you jump into training your ragtag band of Vietnamese guerrilla combatants and setting up your camp in the jungle with limited supplies, and then you move on to a series of operations against Japanese forces. This is all real war story stuff. You've got, you know, big groups of characters coming up against other groups. You've got, you know, lists of like how many of this kind of rifle you have and how much of this kind of mortar that you have. In keeping with this, this adventure adapts the Battlefield Horror Factor rules from Rift's World Book 11. Horror Factor, for those of you who don't know Palladium outside of Ninjas and Super Spies, where they don't really use Horror Factor, it's basically a simple fear rule. If you're a scary being or thing, you have a horror factor, and then anybody who runs up against that thing has to make a d20 roll that equals or beats the horror factor, and if they don't, then they get scared. Normally, horror factor is for demons and stuff, but these rules use the same basic system to represent battlefield morale instead. The exact timing on how these rules are supposed to work is a little unclear, but basically, you roll against each source of fear the first time you encounter it. If you fail, you take a little penalty and lose an action. If you fail a second fear check in the same battle, you lose all your actions until you escape from the source of the fear. I originally thought that was kind of weird because if you lose all your actions, you can't escape the source of your fear because you can't move, right? But the explanation is these rules weren't originally meant for normal, like run-of-the-mill fear. These were originally shell shock rules, rules for what we would nowadays probably call PTSD. And they're meant to represent a character who has PTSD and is totally incapacitated and goes catatonic in the face of a specific stimulus. Only what these rules do is expand it to all characters and all scary things rather than a specific stimulus. So this is a gigantic problem because ninjas and super spies characters, first of all, don't get any bonuses to horror factor because that's not in ninjas and super spies. And these difficulties are pretty high. For example, just the sound of battle, like before anything even happens to you, just the sound of battle, you've got to hit a 14 or better on a d20 not to be scared by that. When a teammate takes damage, you have to roll a 16 or better to avoid fear. Both of these are things that are going to happen in every fight, particularly in this first part of the campaign, right? You're leading men into battle in a military environment. You're doing like small unit jungle combat stuff. Every fight, there's going to be the sound of machine gun fire, and one of your, you know, hapless Vietnamese mooks is going to get hit, at least, if not one of the player characters. In any fight where both of those things happen, which is like all of them, each and every player character has a 48 or 49% chance of going catatonic and being completely helpless. And those aren't the only things that force you to make a horror factor roll. Anytime you try to initiate close combat in this kung fu game, you have to roll against horror factor. If you're ever outnumbered 3-1, you have to make a roll. If you see an officer hit, which since you're playing the officers, basically all of these guys that you're trying to train, the Vietnamese guerrilla combatants, anytime one of the player characters get hit, they all have to make a horror factor check or go into, you know, one big synchronized coma. This is where I have to draw the line. This is not the true meaning of Chop Sock Ability. I'm sorry, but if I assemble my four friends to play a kung fu game, let's say one of them starts getting choked, right? I'm using all the material from all the rifters because I am a maniac. And there's a, you know, Brazilian jiu-jitsu guy here who somehow fell in with the Japanese forces. And he starts choking one of the four player characters. There's like over a 10% chance that all of the rest of the party, his other three friends, all go into simultaneous fear comas. And he just gets choked to death. My feeling is that at this point, it hardly matters whether we're wearing poodle skirts. This just does not have that high-flying 1950s action feel that I'm looking for. So as the founder of the genre, I am calling the police. I am pressing charges. This will not stand. So you go on to a number of actually pretty interesting, well-detailed encounters against the Japanese forces. Nonetheless, they're all going to be a pain in the ass to run because just by the nature of Palladium combat, like take the very first encounter you have, right? You've just barely trained these guys. There's actually a random table of like stupid things that your trainees can try to do, like, you know, shooting themselves in the foot, accidentally using a mortar to blow up their own house. It's really a bad news bears situation here, but you've finally got your guys, like they're ready for the, you know, for the playoffs. So you take them out to attack a small Japanese outpost. This is like small unit tactics 101 for Palladium players. It's you, it's your top trainees, however many you want to take, up against a bunch of the Japanese forces, and there are also some French guys who show up and want to tag along for some reason that involves, you know, deep political motivations. No time to get into it here, but don't worry, there's plenty of it in the article. If you love speculating about the motivations of the French, this is the scenario for you. So anyway, these guys want to tag along. If they do, you're talking about a combat with like 34 combatants in it, which is nuts for Palladium. Like even in gunplay where people are not making parry rolls, so the number of rolls does not, you know, bloat exponentially, you're still talking about having to resolve like 60 rolls per round of combat on top of whatever the player characters do. That is a totally unsustainable amount of rolling to do at the table. And this quickly escalates. Like soon you're getting into scenarios where you've got hundreds of people involved. There's no way that you can roll this out. So you're just going to have to abstract it, right? There are no mass combat rules presented, but you're just going to have to come up with some ad hoc system for figuring out what all these mooks are doing. Unfortunately, because your player characters, due to the horror factor rules, are constantly on the verge of breaking down into a catatonic state at the sound of combat, it's very likely that these giant, you know, 200 plus combatant combats are going to end up being decided by those abstract rules while the player characters are all, you know, laying flat on the ground, totally crushed by terror. But okay, let's assume you make it. So you're all bringing your different abilities to bear to train up these guerrilla combatants. Finally, when they're ready, you find out that the commander of the enemy forces is Colonel Arita, who set up a headquarters in an old Buddhist temple. So in a major climactic encounter, you take your ragtag band in a raid against the temple's hundreds of defenders. And then once you penetrate the base's defenses, you confront Colonel Arita, who turns out to be an invulnerable demon in a chamber of human skulls, who crushes you, leaves you to die, and then you're rescued by Himalayan monks who kidnap you and teach you kung fu for the next 9 years. Yes, that's right. Say goodbye to your lovable band of Vietnamese guerrillas. Say goodbye to your job at the OSS. Forget about World War II, in fact. Forget about your previous character concepts. It turns out the character creation was a cruel prank because your character has been hijacked via the intermediaries of the Young Monastery monks. The Young Monastery contains 5 monks. Each one of them knows one martial arts style and has a different alignment with a different worldview. Each player has to choose one of these monks to be his personal sensei and role model. You then learn that monk's kung fu style. You become a kung fu master. You adopt that monk's alignment. You adopt that monk's worldview. Presumably, you start wearing his clothes. You do your hair like he does his hair. You become a junior, inferior version of this NPC character who tells you what to do and what to think. And you are then visited by the GM's best friend, Destiny. It turns out that Destiny has foretold that all of these OSS agents from different walks of life are all reincarnations of students of these monks who have been brought here to reassemble, learn 4 very specific kinds of martial arts, and forsake their previous lives to hunt the demon called the Overlord across Indochina. So if you were having a lot of fun playing like a, you know, goofy radio age Gizmeteer who is like the gadget guy for the OSS, forget it. That's done. Shave your funny little mustache. You don't even like the radio anymore. The radio is for losers. You're into kung fu now. Needless to say, this is going to be tremendously popular with the players who've just spent the first leg of the campaign, you know, memorizing all the like names and motivations of all these different figures in the American and French militaries and learning to distinguish and like navigate their subtly different geopolitical goals for the post-war. And then it's like you wake up and you're in a monastery and it's like, oh yeah, by the way, 9 years have passed. You're a different character now. The whole first part of the campaign was just a cold open. This show's actually about kung fu demon hunting. So anyway, it's now 1954. You have no connection to your old life. You don't even know that the war has ended, let alone how the world has changed. And the Council of Senseis sends you out on some test missions to see if you're ready to go fight the final boss. So anyway, you pass your martial arts tests, which is weird because some of you already knew martial arts, but that wasn't good enough for the senseis. They had to teach you their martial arts. These senseis are bad dads. One feels that in another time and place, they would have been kicked out of a lot of Little League games, but the stakes are much higher here. So the monks send you to track down the Overlord in Dien Bien Phu, where their contacts have informed them that he has a new stronghold. What these interestingly inconsistent contacts have failed to mention is that World War II ended, like 10 years ago, and that the whole situation has changed, military lines have been redrawn, the Vietnamese guerrillas are now the enemy, and now may not be the ideal time for a bunch of legally dead American spies with 10-year-old papers to wander out of the jungle and ask the French what's cracking. But that's what they do, because they're player characters. They very nearly end up fighting the French, and then once that misunderstanding is all worked out and the French know that the PCs are Americans, they're like, yep, you do seem to be those agents who've been missing in action in Asia for a decade after that horrible operation against the Japanese that went awry and everybody died. Well, I guess you work for us now. Like, welcome to the French military. So inexplicably, you go through these military missions with the French, despite the fact that you don't even go to this school, and you manage to piece together clues as to where the Overlord is. He's up on a mountain, you climb up there, you have a big climactic battle with him, some Chinese nationalist soldiers, and like 10 animated metal animals that he has. Each of which has a horror factor, by the way, because we all know there's nothing scarier than a metal dog. They also clank a lot when they run around, right? So that's going to be a noisy battle. So, once again, after a campaign spanning a decade in the fiction, and probably years of real time as well, it's very likely to end with your characters, wait for it, catatonic from fear as the plot resolves itself. We absolutely must maintain the possibility of slipping into a fear coma, because God forbid we depart from a realistic portrayal of the psychological toll of war while we're fist-fighting copper pigeons on our way to the Demon King. Anyway, this article ends with a very quaint paragraph where the author gives you his email address in case you have any questions, and that's it. So anyway, throughout this article, there's a bunch of really helpful material about how to use it in different ways. It's really well organized. You can skip different parts. You can plug different parts in. You can use this as the framework for a whole campaign that meets your own creative goals. It's really fucking great. I love it. I'm sorry. But my appointed duty is to find the dumbest thing that's in this article, and that's what I'm going to do. I could point to the horror factor rules, which were already bad rules before this author got a hold of them, but it should have been a tip-off that they were meant to reflect the effects of severe post-traumatic stress, and they're instead being applied to literally everyone before they've seen 1 second of combat. It's just a little much. Like, there could be pathos in these rules, but when you've got a fresh-faced officer, like, straight out of the academy, literally going catatonic the first time he has to punch somebody, and that's happening across the battlefield, it's just a little much. The lack of mass combat rules in encounters with hundreds of soldiers that you, I mean, even the most masochistic of Palladium fanboys is not going to sit there and go through the whole Palladium combat process for literally hundreds of combatants every round, even as they are quickly lost to the icy grip of Fear Coma. This needed mass combat rules and didn't get them, so that's another problem. The dumbest thing in this adventure, this campaign really though, is that halfway through, after doing very detailed character creation, you're playing OSS officers in a very specific context, a time, a place, an organization. You've got your background. God knows you've got plenty of personal quirks because you've gone through the laborious Ninjas and Super Spies character creation process. And then you've spent a third to a half of the campaign developing relationships with a tight cast of NPCs. It does seem like a little much to pluck you out of that at that moment, forcibly cut off all your relationships, forcibly change your alignment, forcibly change your character concept, and basically turn all of the player characters into inferior clones of the Council of Senseis. Kung Fu is cool. You're never going to hear me say Kung Fu isn't cool, but nobody wants to get monk-napped, especially after spending like an hour laboriously creating a Ninjas and Super Spies character in the first place. Even with all that said, though, this is probably the single best thing for Ninjas and Super Spies that I've talked about on the podcast, so I can't judge it too harshly. Maybe I'll take advantage of that last paragraph and email the author telling me he did a good job. Speaking of that author, join me next time for a coda that he wrote to this adventure, a short scenario that fits into its continuity, called Hell Froze Over, on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Did you know that this New Year's Countdown is also a shameless fundraiser for MDC Season 2? It is! A second season about Heroes Unlimited is in the works, and if every regular MDC listener made a one-time donation of $3, its hosting costs would be paid for. If you accept this mission, go click my coffee button at ko-fi.com/megadumb. That's ko-fi.com/megadumb. The future of heroism itself depends upon your podcast patron dollars. No pressure. This has been part of MDC's 2017 New Year's Countdown. A new episode will drop every day through January 1st. Contact or check out the podcast wherever you want. It is Mega Dumbcast on Twitter, Instagram, Gmail, Podbean, your podcatcher of choice, etc., etc. MDC, Palladium Books, Ninjas and Super Spies, The Rifter, and all associated trademarks are property of Kevin Sambita. This theme song is New Year's Party by Topti Jin by Kim and Buran, whose work you can find on freemusicarchive.org. Dumbheads, I will catch you next time.